Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing fine, Justin. Thanks for asking.
Awesome. We've had some crazy disasters lately with hurricanes and shootings, and just the world seems to be in chaos right now. If you've ever thought about donating anything, money, time, supplies, whatever, I think that now would be a good time to donate blood, go volunteer, send money if you have it, and just put some more love out in the world. We do have a listener that's living down in the Caribbean, and her island was leveled. If you go out to YouCaring and search for Salty Passports, you can donate there. But if you have any time, any supplies, let's try to counter the chaos that's going on right now. Tonight's episode is the Happy Face Killer, and I think we're going to skip the summary just to keep some of you at bay. Just listen. The story will unfold.
But I do want to say at the very start that the killer had a past of extreme animal abuse, and it's so bad that I'm just going to say that we're not even going to go into the details of that. So if you want to know about the extreme animal abuse that this person perpetrated in the past, then by all means, look it up on the internet. We feel that, yes, that's a part of the past, but it's pretty bad.
January 21st, 1990, Portland, Oregon. A woman named Tanya Bennett, 23 years old, goes to a bar and is playing pool, talking, drinking. She's very outgoing and she's very sociable, and she likes to talk to other people. So the bar scene in Portland is pretty much perfect for her. She leaves with a man, and she does not return home. She is not seen again. On January 23rd, a local student is out in the Columbian Gorge. And if you've never driven that, it's a beautiful drive. But they find a horrific scene. They see a body that's been dumped off on the side of the road. And the police are called. They come out. She had obviously been beaten and strangled to death. But they couldn't find any evidence on her body to tie it to anybody.
She still had a ligature around her neck and part of her jeans was missing, which does seem a little odd.
Yeah, they were like torn at the zipper. The police have very little to go on. They're questioning the locals, but there's nothing happening here. February 5th, they get an anonymous call, and the person, the caller, says that she knows who the killer is, but she doesn't leave her name or the killer's name. She calls back and later identifies herself. She is 57-year-old Laverne Pavlinak, and she says that her boyfriend is responsible for this murder and that she's been in a long-term abusive relationship with him and that he lashes out at women and he's been bragging about this murder, right?
Yeah, her boyfriend, John Sosnowski, who is 20 years her junior.
And at first the police are thinking Laverne's 57 and John's younger. This is kind of an odd couple and they're not taking Laverne seriously at first. So she says, well, I'll tell you where he lives and you're going to find some evidence at his house. And she even gives them a piece of blue jeans that's been torn. And she hands that to the police and say that that belonged to the victim. The police go to his house. They execute a search warrant. They find a note in his bedroom that said, T. Bennett, good peace. And they also find a purse that Laverne says belongs to the victim. The cops are thinking, we might have something here. We have a purse. We have ripped jeans. We have this piece of paper. But they're not moving forward yet. They're trying to get this together. They even take the piece of torn jeans and have it analyzed. And the fibers and the way it's torn, they don't really match up with the victim that was dumped on the side of the road. But Laverne is adamant. And she says, I was with him when this went down. And he was supposed to have sex with her. And then it went downhill. He started attacking her, and I literally helped him strangle her with this ligature. And she gives them a full confession, right?
Well, their next step is they want to take her to where the body was dumped, but they want her to sort of lead them. But they're still very skeptical of her. And to give you some idea, with all the evidence that she's brought forward, some of it doesn't seem to work. And so they're wondering if she's been following this case in the media and has been picking up all the information and trying to match it. So one of the things they do is they make sure that she can't see the mileage, that she doesn't know how far out they've driven so that she can't just say it's been this distance. So now I know we're in the area because it was stated in the media how far out the body was found. So they get her out that way. And she literally leads them to where the body had been dumped. At this point, they're thinking, all right, so not everything she's saying is matching up. But, you know, sometimes people can't recount things perfectly. So maybe she's not batting 1,000%, but she's still doing pretty good. Now it's time to take it seriously. And what do they do after that?
Well, they have a confession from her. The investigators take all of this to the prosecutor. Her confession and all the evidence that she's provided. And the prosecutor takes one look at him and says, why isn't she behind bars? Why isn't she in custody? So they go out and they arrest her and John.
The prosecutor sounds almost irked, right? Like, why isn't she behind bars? But isn't this because there is some skepticism about her story even then?
I think so. I think that the police were trying to take their time. They were trying to vet this person, but she was so persuasive that she got them on her side. And they were not arresting her outright because they're like, well, we're going to gather up as much as we can so we can really nail her to the wall. And she doesn't think that they're moving fast enough on her boyfriend. So she's giving them another, you know, breadcrumb. And finally, she gives them the whole loaf with a confession.
It's almost like they're both yelling at the investigators And they're like, all right, fine. We have a lot of evidence here. Yeah. Let's just move forward.
I mean, when the prosecutor says, I have enough to charge them, I mean, typically it's a little bit the other way around where the investigators are saying, I have the smoking gun, and the prosecutor is saying, I need more. Give me more. But in this case, the prosecutor's like, you need to get them in custody right now and let's start charging them. They bring Laverne in and she's given them everything they need. And a trial date is set. She is indicted, the whole nine. John is still going through processing. He's a little bit delayed in this whole deal because he is the murderer and Laverne is the accessory, I guess, or the she assisted him. So it's easier to get her because they have a confession. So she goes to trial first. When the trial starts, Laverne says she wants to take the stand, which typically the accused doesn't like doing that, but she has something to say. She recants her whole entire story. She says she's made the whole thing up. Now, she knew where the body was. You know, she said her boyfriend did this. She was with him. She gave graphic details of all these things. And the prosecutor is like, I don't think you're making this up. And if you lied about it then how do we know you're not lying about it now? Like, this is insanity. So no, we're going to go ahead and proceed with this. Her defense is trying to show that all the information she had was in the newspapers, the media, and that's how she knew where the body was dumped. But the system's not having it. She's given too much information. She's given a confession. They're going forward. And she is found guilty. Victim impact statements are read. The judge gives her a tongue lashing about how this is the most heinous crime he's seen in his district, his county. And she is found guilty as being an accessory to murder. And at that point, John, who has been maintaining his innocence or saying, I had nothing to do with this. But again, there was a purse and a note at his house. He was pleading not guilty from the beginning. But after Laverne is found guilty, he sees that it's not going to go well for him. And he changes his plea from not guilty to no contest. And he's trying to play damage control now because he knows he's going to get possible death penalty or just a heavy sentence. So he's trying to just get out of this with less time. The prosecutor also plays her full confession for the jury in all its glory. And she talks about using this cord to strangle the life out of Tanya. And this has a big impact.
Right. I mean, why would she say that if she didn't do it, right?
These are graphic details of a heinous crime. She talks about the rape. She talks about him beating her. It's horrifying.
Because he pled no contest, I don't know if this is mercy, but he was given life in prison and he's not eligible for parole until 15 years in.
So January 31st, 1991, Laverne is found guilty. And shortly thereafter, John is given a life sentence. They have these horrible murderers off the street.
So that's a wrap, right? We've found the killers.
Yes.
This is it. It's over, right?
This episode's called The Happy Face Killer. So I don't know where that fits in yet.
Something happened during the trial. And I think this is what, toward the end of the trial?
Yeah, it's very close to the end.
There was a truck stop in Montana. And inside of a bathroom stall, there was some graffiti. And it said, January 2190, killed Tanya Bennett in Portland. Two people got the blame, so I can kill again. Cut bottom off jeans. Proof.
That's kind of creepy, but, you know, we have two people that have, at least one person that's confessed and another person that's been convicted. So who's going to listen to some Yahoo scrawling garbage in a Montana bathroom stall?
I don't know why it would matter at all myself. I mean, if I had heard about that, I would say, eh, there's all kinds of stuff written in bathroom stalls at truck stops. March of 1994, an anonymous letter arrived at an Oregon court. And this handwritten letter seems to be written possibly in the same hand that wrote the message on the bathroom stall door. And in it, whoever had written it had claimed responsibility for the death of Tanya Bennett and said how he killed her and how he dumped her body.
Very detailed.
At the end of the letter, it's signed with a happy face. And then just weeks later, another letter that's similar in nature is sent to a local newspaper in Oregon, and it's signed the Happy Face Killer.
Now, between these two letters, it's not just Tanya Bennett. He details multiple murders, right?
Yeah, and in the letter sent to this newspaper, a reporter named Phil Stanford received the letter. And the letter details murders of five different women around the country. So it's not in one state. It involves different states.
They already got these people in jail or prison. They got their people. So they're not taking these letters very seriously, right?
Right. So if you doubt these messages that are being sent, either in a bathroom stall or to a court or to a newspaper, then what's going on here? Well, one of the ideas is that maybe someone's trying to get John Sosnowski off the hook. You know, if he's in prison and yet someone else is saying, hey, I'm a killer and here's my nickname, that's almost too good, right? Well, maybe he's just trying to get off the hook here.
Yeah, it's a weird scenario and the police are a little baffled by it, but the details are so graphic and they start to look into who are these other women? Where are these other crimes happening at? And they start going through that.
As they go through the letter and they're trying to figure out if there's any validity to this, they are finding that there are investigations in the areas that are hinted at in the letter. So now you're wondering, wait a minute, maybe this is a legitimate letter and maybe there is a killer out there and there is a body count.
And the killer is detailing the way he killed them, what he used, and he mentions duct tape. And some of these investigations, the victims show signs of glue from the duct tape on them. They've all been strangled. He's nailing all the details.
Yeah, one of them, he talked about stepping on a girl's neck to make sure she was dead. That's pretty specific. If someone's giving you even better information than Laverne did, then shouldn't this give them pause?
Yeah, I think that I would be skeptical of these letters at first, but once they mention multiple murders and each one of them is slowly panning out, you have to look at it. And I'm glad they are looking at it and they're starting to take it more and more seriously.
Well, I think one of the things that trips them up is the fact that these are happening in different states, and it just seems not so likely. A lot of killers will kill in an area in a specific state. And this person is saying, yeah, I've killed these different people and in different states.
True. It's like randomly picking out unsolved crimes across the country.
And because they can't find anything to connect these different women that had been murdered, and they couldn't even identify one or two of them at the time, maybe there is no connection, right? So maybe this guy is pulling their leg.
So the cops don't know what to do with this information, but they're following their leads. And eventually, something happens, and our killer will reveal himself.
Yeah, on March 11th, 1995, a woman by the name of Julie Ann Willingham is found in a heavily wooded riverbank, pretty close to the Columbia River. She was 41, and they could tell that the way her body was positioned, that she had just been dumped there. In other words, and this is also the way a lot of the other murders happened, was these women were killed in one place and then taken and dumped somewhere else, which will make a lot more sense later. They could tell that she had been bound in duct tape. She had it on her neck and on her face. And when they did an autopsy on her, they did a rape kit and they also took blood. Now, the autopsy showed that she had been raped and the cause of death was strangulation. They have her identity and they start talking to people she knew,
including her family.
The real break happens because of what?
They're talking to her family and they mention her boyfriend, who's this huge freaking guy named Chris. He stands 6'7" and he's a truck driver. So they look into this guy named Chris, but they're not coming up with a lot of information. They don't know his last name. So they look into Julie's background, and the family mentions, well, he helped her buy a car. So they go and look at the bill of sale. And whenever you sell a car, you know, the title in the bill of sale, you have to have a witness sign it, right? And they find a name, Keith Hunter Jesperson. So now they have a real name, nowhere close to Chris. And they throw that in their computer system, and they're still not coming up with anything. This guy's like a ghost.
And it may be because he works as a long-haul truck driver. So he's not around very much. He's usually out on the road.
He doesn't have a mailing address. He doesn't really have any place he calls home because he's always on the road. But they eventually can find the company he works for, and they start tracking him that way.
They contact that company that he works for, and the company is very helpful. They give investigators essentially his itinerary, and then don't they set sort of a trap for him?
Well, actually, I guess you could say they ambush him, but they're waiting for him at his destination for questioning. He is detained, and the investigators in Oregon are giving the police and law enforcement in New Mexico all their questions for him, and they want him to be interviewed. They tell him that they're questioning him about his dead ex-girlfriend, and Keith doesn't ask anything about her, how she died, what happened, doesn't even seem that surprised that she's dead.
Or he just doesn't seem to care. But he does have a story. He said that the last time he saw her, they were sitting in a vehicle together, had an argument, and then she got out and left. And he said, I don't know what happened after that. I never saw her again.
So big fight, and she took off. So they get hair and blood samples from him. They talk to him for 5 hours. So they're really honing in on him. But they don't have enough. So the detective hands him his card and says, well, if you can think of any other details, please give me a call. And they leave Keith to his own thoughts.
And days later, the detective gets a voice message, and it's from Keith Jesperson saying that he wants to turn himself in. That just seems unbelievable.
I wish they could all be this easy, right?
Some people said that Jesperson did this because he wanted to get credit for what happened, for these crimes. And if you think back to the bathroom stall, to the letters that were being mailed, it did seem as though this happy face killer wanted everyone to know who he was, at least that there was a serial killer out there by that name.
True, but I think he wanted, like most serial killers, everything's on their terms. So he knew that they were closing in on him, and he didn't want to be arrested or taken down on law enforcement's terms. So this is on his terms, and he gives them a full confession over the phone. It just seems crazy to me, but I think he knew that they were closing in.
He's able to give them details on how he murdered his girlfriend, Julie.
And now that we know he's a truck driver, all of these other murders start to make more sense, that they were random people in different states across the country. This reminds me a little bit of that Killing Season that we watched with the truck drivers. And no offense, I have a friend that's a truck driver, so you guys are good people, but it's a little creepy to think that this is the perfect career job to be a serial killer.
Right. You could pick up someone in one state and drive them two states away and murder them. And now there's a body in a state where the authorities there have no way of tracking who that person is because they didn't live in that state.
Yeah, there's no, the missing person report, all that is pretty state specific. So they have to go that extra mile, start going through federal documents and whatnot, which that, as we know, the paperwork and the database isn't quite there.
And if you think about the 1980s or 1990s, this would be much more difficult to track.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Keith had also sent a letter to his brother, which seems a little weird, but he apologizes to his brother for screwing up the family. But he also admits to all these other murders and has multiple details about them. So it's like a second confession letter. And he tells his brother, this is just between me and you. This is for your eyes only. But his brother turns around and hands it to the police, like he should.
Well, I think it's great because so many people might say, if you're family, I'm going to be with you no matter what. But look, if your brother's a serial killer, you need to turn him in.
Yeah. So they get this letter, they pull DNA and, of course, the writing on the letter. They match it to the other letters that were sent to the court and the reporter. And they're matching up the handwriting.
We had mentioned that one of the letters had been signed with a happy face and another one had been signed the happy face killer. It was after all of this happened with his brother turning in the letter, his confession, that now he admits I'm the happy face killer. So we have the crime solved, right? There are 8 murders in total and this man is responsible. His confessions actually matter because he's able to give the actual details and they can confirm these details.
But we already have people in prison for Tanya. That's weird.
You have Laverne Pavlinak and John Sosnowski in prison for the murder of Tanya Bennett, but now they actually have the real killer. So you would think, oh, well, now they can go to a judge and get that judge to toss out their convictions and they can be released and rejoin society, right?
Well, if you watch Law and Order or any TV show, that's all it takes is just, hey, I didn't do it, this guy did. And then the judge goes, oh, let's write this situation. But yeah, our system doesn't seem to like to reverse things. And when they get a conviction, they double down on that. And not only does our system like to keep people in prison that they've convicted, but even the prosecutor and the defense teams, whatever, they don't always work together on these things. So you have to get the killer's defense team to give all this evidence to Laverne and John and their defense teams, and then they have to coordinate, then give that to the prosecution and the judge. It takes a while, and they've already been behind bars for almost 4 years for this murder. Their appeals are not really going anywhere because they have a full confession. Due process was served, and the system dotted its I's, crossed its T's. No harm, no foul. They did the right thing.
October of 1995, even the prosecutors are on board with releasing these two people, Laverne and John. Well, they have the prosecutors on their side. Now they just have to approach the judge, which they do. The defense and the prosecutors approach the judge and they say, "We have proof the real killer has been captured. We have full confession. We have DNA. We have handwriting. This all matches up."
This is unheard of. This is not what happens ever. What does the judge say?
The judge said that they're going to remain behind bars because the jury had rendered its verdict. So the jury spoke. That's it.
You're disrespecting the jury's decision. Unbelievable.
There's a lot more to this in terms of what can be done once people are convicted. It's not much. It's up to the judge. The judge has all the power here. And you would think having the defense and the prosecution joining forces to try and release these people would mean something. And at first, it looks like it won't matter because the judge says no. But there was another hearing set for the following Monday. And this is where the judge finally capitulates and says that he's going to set aside the convictions for John Sosnowski. And then starts talking about how his civil rights were violated by Laverne Pavlinak. And he just reads her the riot act. He is really, really angry. The judge is so irked by Laverne because she put herself in the middle of this case, fed the authorities with all this false information, false evidence. I mean, you think about the note. There was a note with the victim's name on it saying good peace. I mean, that's really damning. And then she has her full confession that was played for the court that convinced the jury that she and her boyfriend were responsible for Tanya Bennett's murder. So he's really pissed off at this woman for jacking with the court process, and he does not set aside her convictions. He does release her, but her convictions are not set aside.
Law enforcement, they think that her actions are what allowed the Happy Face killer to continue killing. And I do agree that she threw a wrench in their investigation. But this is a big, big one. If our system's working, if the checks and balances of our legal system are in full effect, this should not have happened. And for somebody to literally point the finger at a random person and just say, "Hey, they murdered this person," just pick any unsolved murder in your town in the last 2 years and walk into a police station and say, "Hey, I did this." I think you could get yourself convicted. And that's really scary. I have a problem here. I mean, I get it. What she did was wrong, and what she did was very detrimental to the case. But if the vetting process goes beyond a reasonable doubt, that didn't really work here. And it's even scarier that in the face of all of the evidence and the truth, the system can still say, "Well, due process was served. We did everything right." Say, "This person committed this crime," and then go to another person and prosecute them for the same exact crime and give a completely different story or theory on the crime and get a conviction there. It's just mind-numbing to me. And I have a real problem with these two people sitting in prison for 4 years. One of them might have deserved it, but the other one didn't. They have no recourse.
The judge had admonished Laverne, and as I said, very, very incensed by what she had done. I mean, he's got a point. She could have completely derailed this case, and then these victims wouldn't have any justice. Not if the wrong people are in prison. But the investigation does turn up that her boyfriend was pretty much an alcoholic, right? And an angry one at that.
And abusive.
Very abusive. And this is what spurred her on to do this.
That was her motivation. She wanted out of this abusive relationship. It makes sense.
But it almost sounds to me like she wanted to make him pay. He had put her through hell, so now she was going to put him through hell. What better way to do it than to say, he's a murderer. Throw him in prison. The judge, I understand why he's angry, but he needs to remember that she's a victim too. Now, she's not a murder victim, but if you're being abused, she's working for self-preservation when she does this, when she confesses to being part of a murder like this. She's trying to get this guy put away because that's how she feels she'll be free of him. So I think I would say a lot more people these days would probably understand where she was coming from. The judge is yelling at her and that's just expected. But I think more and more as time goes on that people start to realize what effects abuse has on a person. And if she's just trying to protect herself, hey, maybe she's just got tunnel vision at the time. Can you blame her? She wants to get this guy out of her life.
She's being victimized, and now she's in such a desperate state that she's willing to give a false confession to try to frame her abuser. You can't script this. This doesn't make it into movies, but I have just as much animosity towards her and her false confession as I do towards a system that would actually allow this to go through and then try to keep them in prison after the fact.
After Laverne and John are released from prison, Keith Jesperson said that he was overjoyed and that he cried, that he was really happy that they were released because they didn't belong in prison.
What a guy.
Keith Jesperson is done for. He's been caught. He's going to prison. He's giving them details on his crimes so that we have a clearer picture of exactly how things go down. Now, I will say that because the killer himself is giving all the information, there's always that possibility that some of the information he gives isn't correct. Because just as he turned himself in on his own terms, he's now giving them information the way he wants to give it.
Yeah, and they're trying to do their due diligence and vet all the information he's giving them and confirm, match that up with all of these victims. And they start with Tanya Bennett, his first victim. And this is the one that's in question. You know, there's a point of contention here. They've already convicted two other people for this murder, and Laverne had a lot of the details right. So they take Keith out in a patrol car, and they say, hey, show us where you dumped the body. Now, if you remember, they pretty much blindfolded Laverne and drove her out into the middle of nowhere, and she pointed it right out. She nailed the spot. Well, it's been over 5 years since this happened, and Keith goes out, and he starts leading the investigators pretty much on a wild goose chase and points out a spot that's completely wrong. It's hundreds of yards from where the actual body was dumped. So they're kind of wondering, wait a sec, is he really telling the truth? Because he doesn't know where he left the body.
So they seem to give up, right?
Yeah.
They drive away with him. And then as they're driving away, Keith says, hold up, I threw her purse out over here.
Yeah. And he points out to this is Oregon. This is wooded area. You have rivers and streams, lots of wildlife. If you've never been there, it's a beautiful place. But it would be a really great place to hide a body or dump evidence because it's just so vast. But he says, I threw her purse out over here. The investigators send out search teams. They go for several days and they're not finding anything. And again, this has been over 5 years. They're giving up. They're saying there's no purse out there. You know, they still have enough details from them to get them on the other crimes, but they're trying to really nail them. They're telling them we're not finding a purse. They've even sent the Boy Scouts out to find this purse. And he says, it's there. I promise you. And he's so matter of fact. I mean, he's matter of fact about all his details, about all of his victims, that they go out for one more and an investigator comes back with Tanya Bennett's ID that he found in her purse, exactly where Keith had pointed out.
Yeah, on January 21st is when Tanya Bennett was taken away by somebody. And we know now that's Keith Jesperson. Months later, on April 12th, a woman carrying an infant, and she appeared to be inebriated, approached Keith Jesperson. And he convinces them to get in his car. So she's got this baby with her. He drives them out to a remote location.
He's looking to score, so he tries to solicit her, but she's not into that, and she rejects him.
Now, Keith gets upset and rapes her.
Yeah, she was not into it, and he's 6'7". He's a huge guy, and he just overpowers her.
And he does attempt to murder her because he tries to break her neck. She fights back, and she lets him know that she's got a baby. She needs to care for this baby. I think she gets in his head a little bit, and that helps her to survive. Well, Keith took her and her child back to where he had picked them up at this shopping center.
She calls the police.
There was enough information on him that the police had enough to go on to go and find him and pick him up. And they talked to him. They even cuffed him.
They question him and end up letting him go.
Yeah, they believe his version of events. So he said, she said situation. And apparently he comes across as more believable than the woman.
Well, he's always very calm and matter of fact. And I'm sure she's hysterical because she's just been kidnapped and assaulted.
A charge is filed against him for sexual assault, but he doesn't show up to court. So there's a warrant issued. And in Iowa, he's getting his truck weighed. They had run his name, found out that he had a warrant. And this charge that was sexual assault gets reduced to a misdemeanor. Now, since he's in Iowa and they need him in California where this happened at, they're like, don't bother sending him.
Yeah, it's going to cost the taxpayers too much to extradite him.
But this is bad. I mean, think about it. This is the killer. This guy's going to go on and kill 7 more women. This was an attempted murder. And the charge was just sexual assault. And then that gets reduced to a misdemeanor, which then gets dropped because we'd have to extradite him. And, you know, that's going to cost some money. Not worth it, right? I mean, when you think about what happens to these women, and we're still going through the victim list here, but when you think about what happened to them, this was a point where they could have got a guy and at least put him away. And this is where it's worth it. You know, if you have to extradite somebody for attempted murder, sexual assault, do it. You know, I mean, I'd be happy to hear that my tax dollars went to that. I mean, there's a lot of things I can complain about. But taking care of someone who is attempting to murder somebody and rape them? No, by all means, extradite them.
Exactly. And when they ended up arresting him, they found his name and ran it through the system and they didn't get any hits. Well, right here, this would have been a hit. But since it was never followed through, they didn't do anything with it. I had an illegal left turn ticket in Las Vegas once that I attempted to pay, but the ticket had the wrong district marked on it. And they sent me letters saying that they would arrest me in Los Angeles and extradite me back to Vegas over this ticket. So if that's the level of effort for a traffic violation, then I think a sexual assault charge should weigh a little bit higher on there.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
In August and in September of 1992, two different women are found raped and strangled. One is a Jane Doe, who Keith says her name was Claudia, and the one in September, her name was Cynthia Lynn Rose. Now, of course, Keith has stories about these women and how it went down. He claims that, for instance, Cynthia had crawled into his truck while he was parked at a truck stop, and he was sleeping, and she crawled into his truck.
Yeah, because that's what people do.
Right. So I don't know how that warrants his raping and killing her, but that's his story. Lorianne Pentland of Salem, Oregon, was found in November of 1992. According to information, she was a sex worker. Keith said that she wanted to double the amount that she was charging him for sex, and she was going to call the police on it because he didn't want to pay her more. So he strangled her because he didn't want the police called. In July of 1993, another Jane Doe was found in Santanella, California. Now, the police had her marked down as a drug overdose, but Keith Jesperson said that she was a victim of his. In September of 1994, another unknown woman found in Crestview, Florida. Keith said that her name was Suzanne. But again, these are details that he's providing and they're having to follow up with. And because Keith goes on to say that he would pick women up in one state, drive them to another state to rape and murder them, and then drive them to yet again another state to dump their body. So it's really difficult to identify people when they're discovered possibly 5-6 states away from where they lived.
I think he's giving the details of the murder correctly, but the leading up to it, he always has some sort of version of events, like she crawled into my truck, or she said she wanted to die and I just obliged her. Just weird scenarios that lead up to all of these murders. So, yeah.
And he also said that he would check to make sure they were dead by shoving his fist down their throat or by stepping on their neck. I know that happened once. In January of 1995, Jesperson said that he took a young woman named Angela Surprise from Spokane, Washington, to Indiana in his truck. Now, this happened because she wanted to go see her boyfriend. According to Keith, her boyfriend wanted to marry her, and she was ready to do that because she was pregnant. You know, she wanted someone to take care of her.
And she needed a ride. She didn't have any way to get across country.
So Keith can give her a ride. But the way Keith tells it is that he was taking his time because of the weather and the distance, and she was getting impatient. He said that she would complain if he stopped at a rest stop instead of a truck stop because then she couldn't watch TV or get something to eat or drink. And you get this picture in your head, at least the way Keith tells it, that he's getting more and more annoyed with Angela. Well, we know where that goes.
They meet at a bar and they're talking. They're hanging out for a while to come up with this plan to drive across country. And he leaves with her from the bar. So he's seen with her. He's the last person to be seen with her.
And given his height, which is 6'7", well, I think people would remember that, right?
Yeah, he's a turd in a punch bowl.
Now, Keith said that at one point he was trying to take a nap and she was getting impatient, and he was maybe asleep for about 20 minutes when she's nudging him, trying to get him to get up. So Keith said that he raped and strangled her. And then, because apparently he's this angry, he ties her to the undercarriage of his truck face down, and he puts rope around her ankles and her neck, and he drags her for what, 12 miles to grind off her face and prints to make her unrecognizable.
Well, yeah, he's angered and he knows that he's the last person to be seen with her. So he wants to destroy the evidence. He wants to destroy Angela.
And according to Keith, after 12 miles, he takes what's left of her and throws her into some tall grass off the road. And at this point, it would be pretty difficult to identify her.
And then, as we mentioned before, March 11th, 1995, his last victim, Julianne Willingham, was his 41-year-old girlfriend. And she had just spoken to her mother 2 weeks before she went missing. But they knew she was with this Chris truck driver guy, so that's who they go with after she goes missing.
It was similar to the other murders. She had been raped and strangled. Of course, this is what led to his being caught. So we know that the happy face killer is Keith Jesperson, but you always wonder, why did he turn out that way? Where did he come from? What kind of life was he leading at the time? And we can say that at the time, he had kids.
He was a father of three.
But before we get into where he was at the time that he was committing murders, let's talk about his past. He was born on April 6, 1955 in Chilliwack, British Columbia. So he's Canadian. There were five kids in the family. They said his dad was an alcoholic, abusive, and especially abusive towards Keith. And that Keith was not very well liked in school either. Kids would make fun of him because of his size, which I always find that strange, because if there's a really big kid, why are you picking on him?
I remember they would pick on anything.
Right. And I was there in school when there was a really tall kid and he would get picked on. And I thought, man, if he ever got angry with you, he would kick your butt. They moved when he was younger. They moved to Washington and it just got worse for him. The other kids would call him Igor. So he just spent a lot of time by himself. He rarely had interactions with other people, at least anything meaningful. Again, as I mentioned, there's animal torture and abuse, but we're not going to go through it. If you really need to know, you can look that up. He graduates high school in 1973, doesn't go to college. His dad just said he couldn't do it. And I don't know if it's that or if he just didn't want to help pay for it. But either way, Keith is done with school after high school. Not too long after, within a couple of years, at 20 years old, he marries a woman named Rose Huck. They had three kids together, two daughters and a son, and Keith starts working as a truck driver to support the family, but he's gone a lot. And because he's gone so much, the relationship kind of sours. According to his kids, when he would come back into town, he would treat them great. He would bring them gifts. He would take everyone out to eat within an hour or something like that of coming home. And he would stay the night. And then the next day he'd be gone again and be gone for a while.
There would be random phone calls to the house from other women who would ask for Keith by name. And Rose would say, "Who is this?" And they would say, "This is Keith's girlfriend." And Rose would say, "Well, this is his wife," and hang up on them. And this goes on for a while. He would also kill animals in front of his children. So as much as he treated them well, I wouldn't give him the Father of the Year trophy. Between the time away from home and his affairs that he's having, their relationship ends sometime in 1990.
Right. She doesn't have to worry about sneaking off because he's gone so much that she literally can take her time and pack the kids up and go live with her parents in Spokane, Washington. And I don't know, it doesn't really seem to me that this was a big issue for him, her having left him. I do know that his daughter, and her name is Melissa Moore, in 2005, she went with her husband and her two young kids to visit her dad, Keith, in prison. According to Melissa, she did this because her daughters were asking, you know, "Hey, don't you have a dad?" And well, so she does. She shows her kids who her dad is. Dad's in prison. And that's the last time that she meets with her dad.
She's pretty outspoken about him. There's multiple documentaries where she's, I guess you could say, making amends and trying to apologize for the sins of her father. She's putting her voice out there and talking about the atrocities of her father. So that's, it's a very interesting documentary. I recommend watching it.
Yeah, she's, I think the first time this really hits her is when she needs to talk to this guy that wants to marry her. And she feels like her dad's this dirty thing that's in the closet, you know, and she has to let it out. She has to come clean about it with this guy so that he doesn't find out about it later. And her soon to be husband, Sam, she has to tell him. She says, "My dad's a serial killer and he's in prison." And according to Melissa, Sam takes it just fine. He's like, okay, you know, gives Sam credit. He knows the woman that he wants to marry and he doesn't care who her parents are. He's not marrying them. He's marrying her, which also brings up the question, if her dad's a serial killer, does the DNA matter? Did he pass anything on to her or her kids somehow? She had two kids and she looks into it and she is assured by those who know that she doesn't have to worry about it, that there's not a genetic component here. But as Justin said, there's this guilt that she has. My dad committed these murders. You know, her dad talks about them like they're just like, oh, well, I know that M. William Phelps wrote a book about his conversations with Keith Jesperson. I think he calls him Raven in the book, right?
Yeah.
And really wanted to find out what makes this guy tick. And of course, in that book, Keith Jesperson describes these women in pretty bad, like in a pretty bad way. If you remember the film Silence of the Lambs, it's said in there that these killers will often depersonalize their victims. And that's what he seems to do when he describes these victims. He doesn't talk about them in a very good light at all. So you can imagine Melissa, she's out there and she's trying to speak with people who were related to these victims or speak with other people who are related to serial killers, like the daughter of BTK. And I get it. I think I truly understand why she's doing this, but then some people don't want to hear from her. Or even if they do hear from her, if they hear her out, they have some issues with her doing this. But again, the way she describes it is, having a father who is a serial killer and a pretty nasty one at that, it's a tremendous amount of guilt. And she wants to try and put some good back out there in the world. She doesn't want to be known, I think, as someone who had a serial killer parent, but then has moved on. She's not moved on. This is very, very troubling for her. I think the only way she can deal with it is to acknowledge it constantly and try to make amends, try to talk this out with other people and let them know that she's bothered every bit as much as they are by what her dad did.
Well, and I see where a lot of these victims' families are coming from. The media is frothing at the mouth for blood and bodies, and we want to paint this guy's name and face everywhere as, look, cool guy serial killer, when he's destroyed thousands of people's lives. And the victims' families are like, it's all about him. And nobody remembers his victims. Nobody remembers their names. So they don't want to go back and revisit this. They don't want to give this guy any more exposure, because most serial killers are narcissists and they want the attention. This guy couldn't stand not getting credit for this murder that these other people were accused of. So he had to write letters and taunt the police. You know, he's not that remarkable. They ask him, why did you strangle all of them? And he said, well, that's what I did on the first one. So I just stuck to that plan. Like, he's not real bright. And the only reason why he's getting away with this is because he's a truck driver. And the randomness of it is his shield, is the way he gets away with it.
Yeah, it provides anonymity. And if it wasn't for his killing his girlfriend, who actually may have been his fiance at the time, from what I understand, he would probably have gone on to kill many more people, I would think.
Yeah.
But, and the sad thing is, you know, usually we try to give out some information on these victims. And sadly, there's just not a lot of information on some of these people because some of them weren't really identified. And it's because of the way that he did this. He would go to one state, pick someone up, take them to another state, attack and murder them, and then dump them in yet another state. So just like we talked about on the Killing Season interview, it's so difficult. I mean, thinking about how a truck driver could do this, it's just, if you think about how many truck drivers we have, you'd only need a few of these and they could cause a lot of damage.
I'm always mesmerized by the way serial killers can lead double lives, have families, have children, and then go and do these atrocious things, and how they can compartmentalize this family life and then have this murderous life. But in this case, not only am I just appalled and mesmerized by how he's able to do it, but I was also surprised by how the judge and the system could do it also. And I'm not saying that what they did is as bad as what the serial killer did, but for them to be able to not see that there's two people sitting behind bars for a crime they did not commit was just mind-boggling to me. And that's why I was kind of interested in covering this case.
Yeah, that's what really sets this case apart, I think, when you talk about serial killers, is just how you can have the false confession, which really, I mean, it was her own doing. Can't get that wrong. But she had her own motivations. And then you had sort of a bad guy who was abusing her, but wasn't the serial killer in question, that turned out to be Keith Jesperson. And a lot of times you just have a killer who has their MO and they have their victim type. And in this case, you had a killer who was, I think, enjoying watching two people go down for his crime, but just didn't want them to have the credit, and was rubbing it in the detectives' faces like, hey, look, guys, great job. I'm still out here killing and you've got two people on the hook, so I can keep on doing my thing. So when Keith said that he was overjoyed that those two were let out, I don't buy it. I think he's full of it. Well, before we finish up, let's talk about the Happy Face Killer name, because he gave himself that name. He signed the letter with the smiley face. He said, I'm the Happy Face Killer. What do we know about why he chose that name?
People say that he was a very easygoing, jovial guy. He was always happy. I think he drew happy faces a lot. There's a photo of him at the beach, and he's kneeling down in front of a happy face that he's drawn in the sand. It's just his thing, I guess.
In other words, it may have been whenever he decided to doodle, that's what came out. And so that's what struck him when it came time to give himself a name or to sign a letter.
Yeah, I'm going to keep thinking of the don't worry, be happy smiley face and not associate a smiley face with such a sinister character myself. Now, there was a smiley face killer that came out later. And I think to this day, they haven't actually confirmed if this is a real person or not. But from New York to Boston and across the country, they would find bodies dumped or floating in rivers. And then close by, they would find graffiti with smiley faces. I think to this day, they haven't really substantiated any of this. Thinking Sideways has a whole episode on it. I think I sided with them when I listened to it a couple years ago. So, yeah. And of course, there was the connection of, well, is this a copycat killer of the Happy Face Killer? So, I think the smiley face killer will be something we'll have to look at in the future, possibly. I don't want to step on Thinking Sideways' toes, but I'm sure that there's more information out there now. And I remember a governor or mayor coming out and saying that there was no evidence to it. So we'll have to go back and check that out.
Thanks for listening. We'd like to thank our sponsors.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.